best-selling crime writer Val McDermid, is now visiting professor of Scottish Studies and Crime Fiction at the University of Otago. For the next 3 years, she will spend 8 weeks a year in Dunedin, mentoring postgrad students and teaching undergraduate courses in Scottish Studies and Crime Fiction and Creative Writing, along with public lectures and reading, which is pretty exciting for the University of Otago. Professor McDermid is not only a literary star, but also known for her political and cultural commentary. She has two books out this year, How the Dead Speak, in which her characters Tony Hill and Carol Jordan, bloodied but relatively unbowed, return for the 11th time, and a photo memoir called My Scotland, for which First Minister of Scotland Nicola Sturgeon wrote the foreword and called Professor McDermid Scotland's greatest living crime writer, the Queen of Crime. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Why don't they ever call men the King of Crime?
Well, they're not monarchs in the way that we are they?
No, well, there's a point. And you're also a rock star.
Yes, I have been described as the Debbie Harry of crime fiction. I front a band called the Fun Loving Crime Writers.
We tried to find a track, but we couldn't just make it fit. You did Glastonbury this year?
We certainly did.
Wow, how was that?
Amazing. It was a fantastic experience. 3,000 people in a tent listening to us. It was quite different from the usual few hundred at a book festival. And we really enjoyed ourselves, though.
What did you play?
Well, we play songs that are covers of other bands and other singers' songs about murder and crime. So everything from I Fought the Law to Psycho Killer and the occasional Scottish murder ballad thrown in for good measure.
Who else is in the band?
Chris Brookmeyer, Mark Billingham, Doug Johnson, Stuart Neville and Luca Vesti.
Great. That's some lineup, isn't it?
It is.
And do you have books at the back to sell and be signed?
Only at book festivals. It's not quite so easy at rock festivals because rock promoters don't really know what to do with books. They know how to sell T-shirts, but not books.
So Tony Hill and Carol Jordan ride again.
Yeah, they do indeed.
But for the last time?
Quite possibly. I think this is certainly the last for a little while. I'm never saying never, because the thing with writing is whenever you think you've said goodbye to a character, they've got a habit of leaping back out of the cupboard and scaring the bejesus out of you. So we'll have to see what happens with Tony and Carol, but I have no immediate plans.
There was an interesting factoid in this last novel that to train cadaver dogs, and because the process of decomposition produces over 400 different volatile chemicals, there's a US company that makes a synthetic corpse smell.
Mm.
I'm trusting you that this is completely accurate on account of your attention to forensic detail.
This is indeed precisely accurate. The dogs are trained to identify various levels of smell that are produced at various stages of decomposition. But all these volatile chemicals are never all present together. So the dogs have to be trained in a specific range of chemicals. It's remarkable how successful they are. They can smell things where we smell nothing at all.
Yeah, dogs are like that, though, aren't they?
Mm.
They've got those dogs that smell money at airports now.
Really?
Yeah, because money's got a special smell.
Really? I could do with one of those.
Yeah. I'm sure you're doing all right, though.
Oh, I can't complain.
In your rewrite of Northanger Abbey, you got up in lights in Edinburgh, did you not?
Well, that was afterwards. The two were not directly connected. The lights thing was a project called Message from the Skies.
You've done this a couple of times, have you?
No, just the once.
Oh, just the once.
Yeah. Right. The brief was that I had to write a short story that could be broken up into 12 sections and projected onto buildings around the centre of Edinburgh. And this was part of the Hogmanay celebrations. It ran through January, from 1st of January to Burns Night on the 25th. And it was fabulous. I had so much support. The guys who did the projections and the light displays did an amazing job. And we worked with composers, so we had soundscapes in several of the venues as well. And they reckon over 50,000 people did the tour, which took about 2.25 hours to complete.
And people would walk around and read your story up in lights as they went?
Absolutely, yeah. We made sure there were plenty of pubs along the route so that when they got too cold, they could go and warm up. And you could do it in pieces. You could do sort of half of it one night and half of it another night, or just, you know, do sections of it and repair to the pub if it was too cold and wet.
Of your... How many series have you got? 4 series?
Yeah, and standalones.
And standalones. Which series is loved most by your readers?
I think for a long time Tony and Carol were way out ahead, but Karen Pirie has started to come up on the rails, and she's certainly become much more popular with the last couple of books. So there are now 5 novels featuring Karen Pirie, and there'll be a 6th one next year, and she has become, I suppose, almost as popular as Tony and Carol, and I think has a growing popularity.
Why do you think it is that some characters strike such a chord?
I think it's all in the writing. I think you have to bring a certain empathy to writing character, and you have to make it feel authentic to the reader. And if you achieve that, then the reader will invest in the characters and stay with them. And there are, you know, a lot of series that you read for the characters as much as for the plots. Because over the years, the writer has invested in the character. And what happens to them feels credible. You know, the way that they respond to the events in the books feels like a truthful account of how real people would respond.
Yeah, I mean, that's the charm of series, isn't it? That people can build on a character and build further.
Yeah, and it's very much a modern phenomenon. If you look at the golden age of crime writing, you know, it doesn't really matter what order you read the Miss Marple books in, because Miss Marple is the same whatever book you read, except her arthritis gets a bit worse as she gets older, but that's true of all of us, really. But there's never any reflection in her person of the impact of the cases she's been involved with. She never stops to think, how is it that everybody I know is a murder victim or a criminal? But I think readers today are much more demanding. They expect us to understand the impact of what happens to us, and characters to carry forward that weight. And so it's incumbent on writers, I suppose, to imagine themselves in the shoes of their protagonist, to think, how would it affect me? How would it affect this character that I've created to have this experience? And so each book is, I suppose, taking them a little bit further down the development of how you cope with these terrible things. And in How the Dead Speak, I think to some degree that is about coming to terms with a long series of terrible events.
The other theme, I mean, there are several themes going on, and it's more than one plot, I have to say. But one of the themes in How the Dead Speak is literacy, consequent upon Tony Hill, who's in jail. No spoiler alert needed. He's teaching the prisoners how to read because they can keep or build bonds with their children, which is a very interesting observation.
Yeah, this came from a project that's been running in Scotland for a few years now, the Violence Reduction Unit, and they've essentially been working on interventions at various points in the lives of violent young men, particularly to try and see if there are ways to reduce particularly knife crime and street violence. And they have had some very significant positive results to this. But one of the things that they have found to be a key intervention point is when a young man becomes a father for the first time. Because most of these young men have had terribly disrupted family lives. They've either had no father figure at all in their lives, or someone who is violent and abusive either towards them or towards their mother. So they have no real sense of how to be a dad. And one of the ways to instill this initial bonding between them and their children, which they want to have, is to teach them how to read stories to their kids. And a lot of these young men in prison are illiterate or functionally illiterate. And so teaching them to sit down with a child's book, to read a child's book, is a twofold thing. You're giving them, if you like, a reason to read something simple, without sort of somehow diminishing their masculinity. And you're giving them the chance to build a bond with their children.
If you sell it the right way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it has proved to be quite signally effective.
And do you take part in those kind of prison education programs?
I don't, because I've got other things to do. I've got books to write and
Well, you've got the University of Otago to attend to, you know.
But I am involved in on the periphery of these projects. I'm the patron of the Scottish Book Trust, and one of the Scottish Book Trust's many activities is to promote this kind of behaviour, this kind of course, this kind of treatment. And in Scotland, we have a system where when babies are born in Scotland, every baby that's born, their family are given a baby box, and that includes a book. And at various points, at 2 years old and at 5 years old, they're given every child gets a book bug bag, which contains books. For a lot of kids who otherwise would have no books in the house, these books are their gift. They're given to them, and it builds a relationship with books, which in turn leads to a more literate society, which in turn leads to a more productive society.
Every single family gets that?
Every single family.
Every single solo parent?
Every single child.
Wow. That's a lovely thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's not just people in deprived circumstances who have no books in the house. You know, you'd be astonished at the number of middle-class homes that I find myself in where there's not a book on sight.
You had books in your house, presumably.
I have a plethora of books in my house. I think they breed at night when I'm asleep.
When you were growing up?
No, we didn't have books in the house because we couldn't afford books. But what my parents did when I was 6 years old, we moved house to live opposite the central library, and that became my home from home. So pretty much every night after school, I was over there getting books out of the library. Because although we couldn't afford books, they certainly encouraged me to read.
Your first novel came, first published novel, I should say, came after quite a successful, albeit brief, career as a journalist, correct?
Yeah, I was a journalist for 16 years.
Not that brief.
No, I started very young, what can I say?
Of course.
I did very well. I ended up as the Northern Bureau Chief of a national Sunday newspaper. But all I always wanted to do was to write fiction. I always felt that
What was the newspaper?
The People.
Okay, a tabloid.
Yeah, but not what tabloids have become. In the 70s and 80s, late 70s and early 80s, when I was first working in tabloid newspapers, they were still newspapers that were about human interest. And the Sunday People actually did a lot of investigative journalism. We were regarded alongside the Sunday Times Insight team as the best investigative journalists in the country. Unfortunately, what happened to British tabloids in the mid-1980s was Rupert Murdoch and Robert Maxwell, and they dragged the tabloids into the gutter of sex and celebrity. So the paper I found myself working on at the end of my journalistic career was very different from the one I started with.
Was that why you quit?
It was one of the reasons why I quit, but it was always, for me, journalism was always only the thing I did to pay the bills until I could be a writer of fiction.
And in 1987 this came to pass. It was the first British crime novel with a lesbian detective. And I remember you saying that getting a lot of the mainstream shops to stock it was quite a struggle.
Yeah, I mean, I was published by a small publisher, a small feminist publishing house called the Women's Press, and a lot of mainstream bookshops just didn't stock their books at all because it was seen as too niche. And certainly for any writer of gay and lesbian fiction back then, getting your books stocked in anything but the more progressive, I suppose, independent bookshops was difficult.
But because of the content, but because of the niche publisher, or both?
But a bit of both. You know, they generally didn't stock things that they didn't think they were going to sell particularly well, and that would sit on the shelf for a long time. So
I don't know. What's the difference between that and homophobia?
I don't think there is much difference between that and homophobia, to be honest.
Okay.
But they dress it up in a commercial decision when what you're really looking at is a different kind of decision. And it's difficult to challenge that often, you know, because there is, the economic argument will be made. But there were a lot of booksellers, on the other hand, who did stock the book and who talked the books up. Because back then, paperback originals, as the Women's Press published, were not reviewed by national newspapers and magazines. They didn't review paperbacks at all. It was just hardback fiction that got reviewed. So it was initially up to booksellers who read the book, enjoyed the book and believed in it and pressed it into the hands of their customers. And then the word of mouth spread and people started to read the books in greater numbers. And by the time the third Lindsay Gordon came out, I had built a pretty loyal following.
Lindsay Gordon, of course, was a journalist who worked in Glasgow and London.
Yeah.
So many people have said, well, she was your alter ego. And to some extent, I suppose she must have been.
Well, she had the facts of my life in some regard. I never worked in London. I always turned down the opportunity.
Manchester was where you were, wasn't it?
Yeah, Manchester. Yeah, I didn't want to work in London because I didn't like London, frankly. But I used the facts of the world that I understood them. I thought it was easier to write a novel where you have a protagonist whose professional life is something I didn't have to think too much about, because I knew what journalists did, I knew how they made a living, I knew the things that were possible and the things that were beyond their reach. So in that sense, I could put that on the back burner because I didn't have to think about it too much and concentrate on the things that I thought I was perhaps less secure in, the details of the plotting and the development of the characters.
I mentioned Nicola Sturgeon before as raving about you in the foreword to your book My Scotland. Presumably the feeling's mutual.
I have a huge respect for Nicola Sturgeon. I think she's that rare thing these days, a politician of principle. I've spent enough time in her company to know that there isn't a mask that slips when she's out of the public spotlight. She's someone who very much believes in what she's doing and believes that that's the best thing for her country and for the people of her country. And she's also a great reader, which means that she has, I think, a wider insight into the lives of other people than most politicians do. She reads on Saturday evenings and she tweets about books on Saturday evenings. So she shares what she's reading with her Twitter followers and discusses it. She interviews writers every year at the Edinburgh Book Festival and indeed now at other book festivals as well. So she does have, I think, a broader understanding of the world than most politicians do.
Do you think that Brexit... Sorry, you probably thought you'd come to a Brexit-free zone in New Zealand. Do you think that Brexit, however it turns out, will in fact increase the chances of Scotland achieving independence?
I think it will, because people are disgusted and appalled by the behaviour of Westminster politicians and the utter disregard for the regions and nations of the United Kingdom that's demonstrated by the politicians at Westminster. If I was Northern Irish at the moment, I would be incandescent with rage at the prospect of what this will do to my part of the UK. And certainly in Scotland, where we voted overwhelmingly to remain as part of the UK, where, incidentally, in the independence referendum in 2014, we were promised that the only way to be sure of remaining in the EU was to stay part of the union of the UK. There's a lot of anger about, a lot of disgust at the lies that have been told us by politicians in Westminster. And the utter disregard with the London-based media for Scottish politics at all. The SNP are the third largest party at Westminster. And you wouldn't think so from the coverage you get in the newspapers. And even the BBC, who have a tendency to go somewhere else in their coverage of Parliament when the leader of the SNP gets up to speak in the chamber. So, yeah, I think we are justifiably fed up with the democratic deficit we see at the moment.
So that would require another referendum?
It would.
And is that going to happen?
I think it is going to happen. The Scottish Parliament has already voted to have another independence referendum. And technically, this has to receive assent from Westminster before it can take place.
Yes. Is anybody home?
Well, exactly. Is anybody home? But I think there are probably... both sides of the House of Commons could probably see advantages to losing the Scottish presence in Westminster. But we shall wait and see.
Because you're so troublesome, you mean?
Because it's troublesome and because it doesn't support either of them particularly in their aims. All the Tory party is interested in is power. And, you know, as seems likely, 50-odd Scottish MPs for the SNP would be something of a drag on that search for power.
And have you always been in favour of Scottish independence, or has time made you feel it's time to quit the union?
I think it's been something that time has worked its magic on, if you like. For a long time, I really couldn't make my mind up. Before the 2014 referendum, I spent a long time, as we say in Scotland, swithering. I couldn't decide which way to go, because it seemed to me that every question that you asked, what was going to happen after the referendum, after Scottish independence, one side would give you one answer and the other side would give you a diametrically opposed answer, and there was no empirical way of balancing which of these was most likely. And so I thought, if I can't look at it from the point of view of the future, let's look at it from the point of view of the immediate past. And I looked at what the Scottish Parliament had done, how they had governed, the decisions they'd made since we had a Parliament in 1999, a Parliament led both by Labour and by SNP at various points. And I thought that when I looked at what they'd achieved and what Westminster had done in the same time, it seemed to me that the decisions of the Scottish Parliament were much more in tune with my own ideas of social democracy and equality and fairness. And so that was what made the decision for me. Based on their record, I thought I'll trust them to go forward.
However, do you have a sadness at the idea of the union passing?
I have to say that the reaction of a significant chunk of the population in England to Brexit has made me feel that I will have very little regret about this. We've seen an ugly uprising of racism and homophobia and misogyny and just general outpouring of vitriol that doesn't seem to me to be the kind of country I want to live in.
Is Scotland immune from that kind of thing?
By and large, it is. I mean, we have our own pockets of problems, if you like. We still have a problem with sectarianism. But we generally are a country that looks outward and has open arms. We welcome immigration. We welcome what we call new Scots. And even though, you know, the 2014 referendum was polarising in the sense of people had very strong views on either side, it didn't provoke the sort of vitriol and hatred that Brexit seems to have provoked.
No, maybe you just didn't have a Nigel Farage involved in that.
I don't know, we had some fairly incendiary figures involved in the discussions.
Somebody's texted me to say, and this came in a few minutes ago, in fact half an hour ago, please ask Val McDermid when we can expect more Kate Branigan novels, my favourites.
Oh, well, I'm afraid I think Kate Branigan is not going to be appearing again. I mean, it's 20 years since
you
I wrote a Kate Branigan novel.
You can't choose this programme to announce the death of Kate
She's
Branigan.
She's not dead. She's just somewhere else. Oh. She's not in my head. You know, it's been 20 years since I wrote a Branigan. The books are still out there for people to enjoy.
Well, he's read them all, this guy.
Can read them again.
He can read them again.
It's been a long time ago now, you know.
He's probably forgotten them now.
And, you know, they're now available as very good audiobooks as well, so that's a different experience again.
Are you reading them?
No, I don't read them.
You should.
No. I wouldn't. Actors need the jobs.
Ah, well,
you know,
there is that.
And you know, I kind of feel like I've gone through this book already and I don't really want to revisit it. Ah, thank you very much.
No, you'd pick out all the bits you wished you'd written differently.
Yeah, exactly.
A nightmare.
I have a friend who reads his own audiobooks and he does precisely that.
Does he?
Yes.
The book I mentioned earlier, the one that Nicola Sturgeon has written the foreword to, My Scotland, it's a rather beautiful thing, isn't it, with that photography by Alan McCready.
Yeah, it's
very
beautiful.
This is your compromise memoir, right?
It is, yeah. Yeah, my publisher kept wanting me to write a proper memoir. There's a big vogue in narrative non-fiction at the moment. And I really didn't want to do it for all sorts of reasons. But then I thought about the importance that location plays in crime fiction. I think the best novel, the crime novels we remember the most are the ones with a very vivid sense of place. And I've written a lot over the years about Scotland, and so I thought it would be an interesting interesting way to do a sort of mashup, I suppose, of a memoir and a kind of travelogue. And so that's how it turned out. And my friend Alan did wonderful, wonderful photographs. And it's a very, very beautiful thing, the book, which has nothing to do with me. It's entirely to do with the photographs and the production staff who did all the layouts. But it is, I think it's a lovely thing.
I think you should still write...
Christmas gift.
Yeah, steady on. I think you should still write the memoir, though.
Well, I don't know. I always think my life's a bit boring, really.
I think that you should let us be the judge of that. Mm. Very nice to talk to you, Professor Val McDermott, who is now Visiting Professor of Scottish Studies and Crime Fiction at the University of Otago. She'll spend 8 weeks here in Dunedin mentoring postgrad students and teaching. She was first in Dunedin something like 20 years ago, I think, upon which she fell in love with the albatrosses.